You are listening to Sparking Wholeness with Erin Carey, where we talk about all things related to nutrition for mind, body, and soul. Are you ready? Let's do this. Hey, everybody, it's Erin Carey. Welcome back to Sparking Wholeness today. I am sitting down with Heidi Schuster. She is a nutrition and body image therapist, somatic experiencing practitioner, and embodiment warrior who writes about whole self wellness. She practices in the Boston area and is author of the award-winning book, Nourish, How to Heal Your Relationship with Food, Body, and Self, and new book, Nurture, How to Raise Kids Who Love Food, Their Bodies, and Themselves. I am so excited to talk about your latest book, Nurture, because the topic of kids and body image and eating in general is a hot topic. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Erin. I really appreciate it.
I'm just so excited to sit down and have this discussion because we talk about kids' health a lot on the show. We've talked about kids' mental health concerns, but I don't know if we've ever really dug into just body image and how we talk about food with our kids and how to nourish a healthy relationship with food and body image. So what drew you to even want to write a whole book for kids to begin with?
Great question. I have been in the field of disordered eating for nearly 30 years. I actually have my own history of an eating disorder in my adolescence. And I think when I was doing my own recovery and started to study nutrition, I found some of like the basic principles around food science to be really enlightening and helpful for me in my recovery. And I went on, you know, to study nutrition and psychology, you know, because of my own journey. And then, you know, in my practice, I've been in the Boston area now for, like I said, nearly 30 years. And in my own practice, I have seen so many different kinds of people recover or do recovery work. I think you can use, I know that term recovery versus recovering is controversial. I think everybody can choose it as they prefer, but I've seen people do recovery work around food and body image and certainly have some thoughts about it. And so I wrote my first book, Nourish, and was published in 2018. And so many people came back to me and said, wow, this really resonated for me. I wish I had this information before, or I wish my parents had this information about how to talk about bodies differently, how to talk about food differently. And it got me thinking, in fact, several people suggested, you should write a book for parents. We need resources mm-hmm. for parents. And so hence I started that journey. And I really feel like it's been a challenging book to write. I'm a parent myself. I have two young adults who are in college right now, daughters. And I have a lot of compassion for parents. Like, parenting is no joke. And so to be able to write something with compassion and with some authority, given that like I do really have some thoughts about how we should talk about food and bodies, was really hard. Like, that striking that balance between like, yes, like we're all bumbling along as parents. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I really do have some thoughts about how we can talk about bodies differently.
Yeah. Can you break down for listeners, because I'm assuming these terms are going to pop up, and I want to make sure that we understand the difference between a diagnosable eating disorder and disordered eating behavior. Can you kind of break down maybe that nuance there? Because I think that that's probably going to play a role in our conversation too.
Sure. I mean, there's like, as you know, in terms of the mental health field, there are diagnostic criteria that categorize someone as having an eating disorder. And I actually am not a huge fan of labels, although I understand why they're used. Obviously, we can learn about how to treat people better, and we can obviously get some insurance coverage for our sessions when we use a particular label. But other than that, I don't think they're super useful. I think that, If someone has disordered eating, or if someone's relationship, I like to use language, if someone's relationship with food feels challenging or funky, then it's worth exploring because there may be some more deeper truths underneath that.
I think anybody who has a history of yo-yo dieting probably has some disordered eating behaviors, kind of as I would say as party favors from
Yes,
whatever yo-yo
yes.
diet they were on.
Absolutely. I think that like it's hard to be particularly someone who identifies as a woman in this culture and not have some disordered eating or body image stuff at some point in one's life, because our I think our culture is so focused on appearance, especially I think there's a lot of focus on women's bodies and has been over the years. So I do think, disordered eating is like a term for like I feel like my relationship with food is off, and I would like to feel more connected to my relationship with food. I'd like to have a relationship with food that felt healthy and nourishing, and to use my word, or and supportive, and it doesn't feel like that all the time. And again, an eating disorder, like a diagnosable eating disorder that might bring someone into treatment, is like, maybe a magnitude greater potentially. But I think lots of people struggle with disordered eating when they're working through challenges and using food as a coping strategy.
I think that that is a really great way to look at it, because I think a lot of times people think of eating disorders as these very extreme examples, when in the day-to-day, I mean, that relationship with food, depending on what we grew up with, what our parents modeled for us, like it's so different for everybody. So that leads me to ask, how is or how does our, as moms, as parents, how does our relationship with food impact how our kids have a healthy relationship with food?
It's a great question. I think it can have an impact. I think it's one of many environmental factors that, obviously there's the broader culture. There's peers and other relatives and friends who model certain behaviors around food as well. But I do think that parents have a unique position where they can be potentially more helpful and also potentially be harmful around the young person's relationship with food. So I think some consciousness to how we talk about food and bodies with kids is valuable. And that's like what I was trying to hope to impart in my book, is like some tips and ways to, like language and ways to talk about food and bodies differently than maybe perhaps we were raised, because I was raised in the 70s, the Diet Pepsi, era, where there was, a lot of dieting talk constantly. And also I think there are a lot more sort of real negative shaming around fat, around bodies, in the, maybe a little bit more than where we are today.
I do believe it's beginning to shift slowly, and we're becoming a little bit more inclusive to understand that, yes, body shapes, sizes, differences. I mean, all you have to do is look at an elementary school playground and you see there's so many different sizes and shapes and bodies, and it's how we are. That's how people are. There's diversity in all of that. But what is some of the language that would you say is harmful and maybe instills fear subconsciously about food or bodies at a young age?
That's such a big question. I've like so much to say about that, but I think one of the things that I can like an example that I can give might be talking about food in a polarizing way. In other words, saying that these foods are good and these foods are bad, or telling children that they should eat more of this or less of that. And it sounds very straightforward, but neutrality about food is really difficult to do when you're a parent.
Totally agree. And I definitely want to take some time to break that down. But before we do, this is a great place to pause and thank our sponsor for today's episode. This episode is brought to you by TrueMeta. TrueMeta itself is a premium supplement company based out of California that strives to make self-care easy. One of their great products, just one, they have other products, is mushroom coffee. That's the one that I've been using. That's the one I've been loving. It is a must for your morning routine. It tastes delicious. It has no mushroom aftertaste. So if you're thinking, ooh, I don't like mushrooms, that's really gross. Nope, that's not what you're going to taste. It just has the benefits that these specific mushrooms bring. I'm talking about lion's mane mushroom for productivity, reishi mushroom for immune support, we all need that, cordyceps to boost energy, and of course, it still contains caffeine to give you the mental focus, the kick that you need every day, and it is organic. You can start your 2024 healthier with TrueMeta mushroom coffee and see for yourself how it helps you focus so you can get stuff done. My husband and I have both been sampling it. He is a therapist and he will take it to work to have right after lunchtime just to give him some added focus. I mean, wouldn't we all love for our therapists to be a little bit more focused during sessions? I know I would. So it's helping him, and I'm sure it's helping his clients as a result because he is so mentally with it. You will feel an uptake in your productivity every single time that you drink it. I promise you've got to try it. TrueMeta offers their very best deal to date only to my listeners. You'll get a free electric mixer and 40% off the coffee, plus free shipping in the U.S. to go right now to trumeta.com/spark to fuel your productivity and creativity with some delicious mushroom coffee. That's trumeta.com/spark. Okay, Heidi, you were talking about neutrality with food. What does that look like? And how do we keep neutral about our kids' food choices? Because, oh, that's a struggle for me.
As a nutritionist and a parent, I even found, and I kind of knew better because I worked in the eating disorders field and I wrote about this in my book too, that I found it was hard for me not to insert my own will in there
I
around,
feel
like,
that.
eat more of this, eat less of that, make sure you get your protein. And I think that, like, while we do want to make good, balanced food available for our kids, we have to be careful not to move over into their lanes and suggest that they ingest more or less of what we're offering. I think we can offer food, we can plate it for them, we can put it in front of them, but they have to select what they actually put into their bodies. And I think if we interject too much dialogue around that, or too much judgment around what's good and what's bad, it just gets confusing for kids because then they're thinking, like, I'm trying to think like a 7-year-old, like, well, this food, mom said this food was bad, but it feels so good in my body. Like, I don't get that. It's almost like confusing and inconsistent. So it's really important to sort of encourage self-regulation in the child.
That's so tricky, right? Because we want to teach our kids to listen to their bodies and to listen to the needs of their bodies. And I think some of the reasons many of us, maybe some of the women who are listening, get messed up about food is because that was too regulated for us growing up. It was, the clean your plate club, or it was eat this or you don't get this. And it's like, oh gosh, well, how do I learn to make my own choices? So women grow up and they've been on the yo-yo dieting wheel or wherever, and like, what do I do? What do I do to help regulate, to your use your word, I love that, my own intake of food? Because I actually don't know what I like. I don't know what tastes good to me because I've just been told all these things.
Right. And we're not necessarily always connected to our true appetite. Like, I do really believe that when people are grounded and very in touch with their appetites, they eat a pretty diverse, balanced, like, pretty healthful diet. But when we're not so connected to that appetite because we've been given lots of external messages about what we should and shouldn't be eating, then we're really outside of our bodies. We're not inside our bodies making choices from a sense of, oh, this feels good. This, like, works for me. This doesn't work for me. That makes sense.
Yeah, you're speaking my language. How much, I mean, I just even the way that you're speaking of that, how much does your somatic processing and that part of what you do play into how we experience food and nutrition?
Well, I only studied somatic experiencing in my later years. I finished my training in 2022. So, I mean, sorry, 2022. So it wasn't that long ago. And it opened my practice so much. I was like, why have we not learned more about this? And I went into it because so many of my clients that I work with have a trauma history, and I wanted to understand how to do more trauma-informed care, especially working with something like food, which is so body-oriented. But ultimately, just working on being more in touch with one's bodily sensations and being more connected to one's body in somatic work is I feel like the special sauce of recovery from eating issues and body image issues. It doesn't make it easy. It makes it quite challenging. Sometimes it's really hard to be in our bodies. Sometimes, especially if our bodies have been violated or harmed in some way. But it can be really powerful to work through that, and sort of come to the other side of really being grounded and present, because that helps us to make choices that are connected to health and true wellness.
Yeah, I mean, and taking that agency back to no, this is I get to choose what's best for my body. Because, yeah, to your point, I mean, our bodies aren't always a safe place for various reasons, whether it's, sexual trauma, medical trauma, a body that feels broken because of a medical issue. I see that a whole lot. And it makes us fear anything that we're going to put in our bodies because, oh, is my body even a safe place? What's my body going to do with it? Let's talk about orthorexia. What is that? How do you support people with that? And what is that? How does that show up in your practice and in your work?
Sure. Orthorexia is a term that not everyone listening might know, so I'll just define it. It's really a focus, an over focus on wellness and clean eating, for example, in such a way that focus on health is actually not healthy in the end. I don't know if I'm articulating this well, but it's kind of like an eating disorder light, so to speak. It's like there, the focus on thinness might not necessarily be there, but the focus on health is there. And so choices are made around food and lifestyle that actually end up taking someone away from their true selves and taking someone away from their values, for example. They become very obsessed about the steps that they're walking or the food that they're eating and how perfect it is, and they lose sight of other meaningful pursuits in their life. So that's I guess that's the best way to define it.
Yeah. And I usually think of it as when the stress of what you're trying to do for your body ends up becoming more of a stressor, right, than a help. It's more of a hindrance than something that's beneficial. And I think that we see that a lot in the wellness world, which is like, ah, oh, it's for good reasons, it's for good intent. But certain personalities, I think sometimes it does have. Certain personalities are going to draw more towards this than others. It becomes more of a, oh, but I can do better. I can do more. I could, and then you're just outside of your body at that point, right? You're not really tuning in. Now it's become more of a checklist or another way to try to cope. And that's what we want to integrate instead of separating.
I mean, often it's a people fall into it, honestly, right? I mean, they're just trying to take the advice of people who seem healthy on the internet, maybe. And then it becomes a control strategy, for example, a way to maybe feel in control of your life. Because, if your food and your movement and all your little ducks are in a row, well, then things are okay. But maybe there's some other kind of chaos that you're experiencing that needs to be dealt with in some way. But food and the control of food and the control of what we put in our bodies or don't put in our bodies can be a way to find a sense of control.
Yeah, absolutely. And, going back to the parent conversation, I think we can very easily do that for our kids because it's just another way we can try to control what often feels uncontrollable, and that is parenting in general. We're out of control of
Yes.
so many factors, right? And so that stress about mealtime, about the nutritional aspect of food, can then translate to our kids. And so instead of offering support and nourishment and pleasure, which I want to talk about, we offer fear and like this controlling, like you eat this and then you. So let's talk about why pleasure is important at family mealtime.
Pleasure is super important, and I think sometimes we lose that aspect of eating. It is so much more, you're going to influence your kids eating better if you make it a pleasurable, fun experience. I mean, this may seem obvious, but when you're exhausted and just trying to get your kid to eat vegetables, it might not feel that way. But if you kind of approach it like, I made some yummy broccoli and it has a special sauce on it. We're going to try it tonight. And you're like kind of light about it. And then it's not so hard to introduce something that might be a little bit foreign. And then if they don't like that food, for example, you don't make a big deal out of it. This kind of goes back to your first question, which is that being neutral about food also means that we're not going to we overreact when a child refuses a food because they're just like exerting their autonomy. And maybe it's because they don't like it. Maybe it's because they're a cautious kid and new things are kind of scary. Maybe it's because they're not sure about the color. Maybe, who knows? It might be the texture. But in general, I think the more we can not get stressed and react to a food refusal, and just keep it light and fun, the better. And I think, talking about your own experiences with food, talking about the things that you like and things that you don't really like that are your own preferences, and modeling a very kind of chill and relaxed attitude about food experimentation, I think, can be really helpful. Like, I didn't like anything with spice when I was a kid, but now I love putting salsa on my whatever. So I think there's a way in which just like being, speaking about preferences and food as fun and an enjoyable and interesting and something to be curious about is definitely more supportive.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I know for me, I have found that when my kids are engaged in the process of making the food, they're much more likely to try it. And they've tried some weird things just by being present and going, here, let's make this together. And that's been really fun. And just talking about, well, let's see how colorful we can make this instead of, making it, well, this is better for you. Ooh, okay. Well, again, like you said, like to kids, that's not. They're not quite sure what that means anyway, right? Because to them, Skittles are better for them. They like Skittles more. And so even using that language, it's like, well, let's just talk about different colors when we're making a meal together and add that in. And keeping it in that neutral category, I think is really helpful. I mean, goodness, I can definitely improve in that area all the time because I want my kids to eat some dang broccoli, right? So what are some other ways?
And helping having them touch the broccoli, in the kitchen while it's being prepared and is helpful. Having them feel a part of the meal, like you said, I think is so valuable. I used to have this like quote that I said all the time, and then my kids gave it back to me, which is, if you help in the kitchen, you get to munch. And what kids don't like to munch? So the more they get used to being in the kitchen, and like touching food and playing with food and manipulating food, then it doesn't feel so scary to be more diverse. And the reality is that some kids are more picky than others,
I was about
and
to
that
ask
also
about
is,
that. Yeah, what about that? And we've got kids with lots of sensory issues and our wonderful neurodivergent children who just get hooked on certain things and that's all that they want. I mean, how do we help support them?
That's such a great question. I have some writing about that, and I think there are even people who work in the area of neurodivergence and nutrition and feeding that are probably even more qualified to answer this. But I do think, like in general, you just have to know your kid and know know how many times they might need to try something before it becomes accepted. My research intern for the book, she and I found out that kids need to try something between 12 and 30 times often before it's accepted, which studies show different amounts, but it was somewhere between 12 and 30 times before a new food might be accepted. And obviously, if you have a cautious child, or a child with sensory issues, then they may take even longer before they accept some new textures and flavors and colors and things like that. And I think being patient in that process and allowing most of the food JAGs that are pretty normal in kids' development to move through on their own is generally the best tactic. Most kids who were picky eaters become more diverse adult eaters. Obviously, if there are some sensory issues that need to be treated, and if there's some occupational therapy or some other work to be done, that would be wonderful and supportive. But in general, most kids do grow out of only liking those white foods. There's a reason why the children's menu always has chicken nuggets on it, and kids tend to like plain, simple food, especially when they're in a foreign environment like a restaurant. Just knowing that that's part of it and riding it out and not getting too excited about it will help to not necessarily prolong that food JAG stage.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you said picky eaters can turn into adults who are enjoy more diverse tastes.
They certainly can. I mean, some of them still struggle. I have worked with folks who have ARFID, which is like sort of a new designation in the eating disorder world. It stands for avoidant restrictive food disorder, who really, really are extremely limited in their options around food. And that may go into adulthood with them. But generally, when they're an adult, they have the agency to say, I'd really like to go out with my peers now that I'm in graduate school and eat something a little bit more diverse than what I usually eat. So I want to work on that with someone who can help me. But in general, most garden variety picky eating in kids does get grown out of.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I was a super picky eater as a kid, like really picky. So that's why I loved the idea of a slim fast diet in high school. Because I was like,
Sure. That's so easy.
really easy, really basic. And yeah, so it's interesting that you say that, but now I love everything. I mean, it's very rare, like certain textures still, if it's too slimy, like for example, mac and cheese, I will gag. I think it's disgusting and it doesn't have enough flavor for me. It's just mushy. So but I've had to embrace the color philosophy and finding different colors, different textures, different spices and seasonings. And now I love a very wide variety of things. So that gives me a little bit of hope for my very pickiest, my last born. He is the baby of the family, but yeah, very picky,
And
and I have some hope.
sometimes it's just preference too. I'm not a big fan of gristly meat. Like never have been. Like like and I'm not like one so I will never, never go out and order a steak because I don't even like it. It's not my favorite kind of food. That's an inherent preference that I had when I was a little kid. So I think there are preferences and things that maybe are good for some bodies versus others, potentially. I mean, why is it that some people love mushrooms and some people absolutely abhor them? Probably there's something about their body, their individual body, that leans them in one direction or the other. I mean, who's to say that there's one choice is better than another. I think they're like, we just have to appreciate, like you said, on the playground, the diversity of bodies and the fact that there are so many different ways to be fed. And I think if we can go at food with that sort of neutral, more, open, philosophy, then kids tend to experiment on their own and come to a place of finding a way of eating that works for them. But, then the culture gets in the way. Like you said, like someone tells you you should drink SlimFast to lose weight. Or someone tells you, like, follow this special diet. My neighbor's doing it and they feel great. So I think that, like, there's so many external forces that will tell you how to eat and really pull you out of your body.
That whole pulling you out of your body, I think that that's so important for women to hear. I know that having a plan, set plan, like, oh, you're gonna have this kind of a snack every few hours, and like for some women that can feel like safety, because it's like, oh, I don't have to think about it and I don't have to stress about it, and I'm just gonna eat this and it's gonna make me magically be how I want to be. But that's taking the agency away from what you need for your body, and it's actually asking you to tune out of your intuition and your needs and to tune into whatever this plan is telling you. And when the plan fails, and it will, what is it, 95% of the time it will fail. Now you're starting all over feeling like you're the one that made the mistake, when it was really just the plan that made the mistake for you. So I think that that's really, yeah, that's a whole other rabbit hole. I do want to talk about the forbidden foods ju and the judgment that we pass upon foods and how that impacts even obsession with certain foods. Like, for example, I don't like ice cream, don't like it. But what I had to do is I had to come to an acceptance that it is okay to eat ice cream. And then I realized I didn't like it. I loved it when it was forbidden for me.
Sure, because
Right?
it was charged, sometimes when we say I can't have something, the young person inside of us, and we all have young people inside of us, says, like, like, I want that. I want the thing I can't have. It's very human nature. So sometimes, like you said, when ice cream, someone or even yourself said, I shouldn't eat ice cream, it almost became more attractive. And then, like, you realize, actually, I don't really like this anyway. This is not my food. So yeah, there's definitely, like, making something forbidden can increase the charge that that food has. So I always cringe when I hear parents, like making candy and things, like, completely forbidden. And I'm not, like, a big fan of, like, stocking your, someone said, like, oh, you telling everybody that they should eat more processed food? I'm like, actually, what I'm saying is, like, we should make food fairly neutral. I think, don't, I wouldn't stock your cupboards with one type of food, but I also wouldn't eliminate all foods, for example, that have sugar in them from your kids' lives, because they'll find it. In
Oh, they
fact,
will.
when I was, my kids were growing up, I say this a lot when people ask me in interviews, but, often the kids from sugar-free households would come over and hunt for the Halloween candy that's, like, dusty on the top shelf, because my kids were done with it. They, like, had their couple of days right after the holiday, and they, like, it was just sitting there. Like, it's those other kids who weren't allowed to sort of have, like, freedom around food that would hunt for it. And I always felt like my kids, and some of it was their temperament, but they had a pretty balanced relationship with snacks and treat-oriented foods, because they were not forbidden.
It's funny. I mean, I have an example. Just yesterday, I took the baby out on a date and, like, where do you want to go? We went to a coffee shop that has really good baked goods. I'm like, all right, what are you going to get? Pick out your favorite. Well, he got this massive chocolate chip cookie and he loves chocolate chip cookies. I love chocolate chip cookies. And so he ate the whole thing pretty fast, where I was like, oh, he's going to get sick. But I'm just, letting it go. He probably was, I don't know, hungry or just excited. I'm not quite sure. He ate it pretty fast. Afterwards, he goes, oh, my tummy doesn't feel so good. It's like, oh, okay. Well, you ate that pretty fast. Like I'm watching him, you know, because chewing is important to me. I do talk about chewing and enjoying and slowing down so we can digest better. But yeah, it was very interesting. I thought, okay, well, maybe what do you think? You know, do you think it was you ate it too fast? And you just at, you know, having that conversation with him because he knew, his body knew. And so I think
Yeah,
that's
he had an embodied experience of eating something like that cookie, big, that's big, and eating it fast, like doesn't feel good in my body. And it's better for him to have that experience himself and just make a, well, it's like a somatic note of it, so that the next time he goes back and there's like a big cookie, he might eat it slower, or he might think, you know, maybe I mean, he's, you know, not sophisticated enough to do this, but if he was a little older, he might say, oh, maybe I'll eat some of it and save the rest for later, and that will make my tummy feel better. So there's a, but that's self-regulation that kids have to learn. It's not so easily taught.
It's so hard. And it's so hard not to quickly jump in with saying, you know, oh, it's because of this, because he has to figure
I
it out for
know.
himself. And I remember the first time my oldest, now she's in college now, but I remember she was 12 or 13. And she was at some event where they had, she's sensitive to, we think it's dairy, never quite sure, but she slowed down on it because something doesn't make her feel good. And she had pizza, then I think it was like cookies and ice cream, you know, your typical teenager food stuff. She said, well, I knew that we were going to have this dessert, so I only had one piece of it. So she was like, you know, at that young age, trying to figure out what's my limit that's going to make me not feel sick, and not in a dieting way, not in it, but just in a, I know my body doesn't love this amount of dairy. I might get sick. So what can I do? And I remember when that happened, I was like, oh, okay, this is good, because that's not what I had for myself growing up. It took me a really long time to go, oh, food makes me feel differently. It was just autopilot all the time.
Well, that's a good sign. It's a sign that like clearly like she developed some sense of what feels good in her body and what doesn't, and that she can make choices from that place. And you know, hopefully be kind to herself in the process too, because we're not always going to get it right.
Absolutely. I think that's important, is teaching that kindness. You bring up such a good point, teaching our kids just that body kindness. And what is going to make me feel good, or what's going to make me feel like I get to choose? And I mean, there's just so much that goes into that. I mean, we could talk about this forever. Is there anything else that you would say in regards to the language around bodies and dieting language and body size and shape language?
There's a lot I could say about that. Definitely have whole chapters about that. But what I can say is it's really important to at a young age just continue to provide the message that, you know, bodies come in all different shapes and sizes. And when a child, a very young toddler, for example, is pointing out a particular body type, like sometimes, like, you know, toddlers will just be very matter of fact and be like, that person has a big belly. You know, to just have a neutral response to that is really important. I think when we get all freaked out and say, don't say that, like, you know, that's not nice, that's our own internalized fat phobia telling us there's something wrong with a belly that happens to be a little larger than average. So I think when we come at remarks like that with little ones neutrally, then it sets up a space for bodies to be more, you know, bodies to this body inclusivity, let's put it that way. And I think as kids are developing too, particularly around puberty, normalizing some of the roundness and awkwardness of the body at that time. And that, like, as we're growing into our adult bodies, that are like, we change our body parts change, and they fill out, and then they stretch, and then they do different things, and that's just part of it. And I think I know I had lots of discussion with little girls in the back seat of my car as I was driving about how it's so normal that you all have like bellies, and bellies are like wonderful, and Like there, eventually you are going to be growing breasts, and like right now, you have to have a belly because that is part of what you need in order to do that next stage of your growth. So I was maybe a little more like kind of focused on that kind of discussion with my kids, and I was a little worried that maybe I overdid it. But then I would hear them talking to their teenage friends, and saying, well, so what? First of all, like you're not fat. And second of all, even if you were, it's just another body type. Like, what's the big deal? And I was like, okay, they got the message because our culture is so like negative about fat bodies. And the reality is that people come in so many different shapes and sizes, and we have to honor that difference.
I'm grateful that we're seeing more shapes and sizes. Like even I think about the Barbie movie recently, and I just went and saw Mean Girls with my oldest not too long ago, the musical version. And both of us, she was like, "Hey, it's kind of cool to see maybe some like just I would just say normal body shapes than what we typically see in movies." And I said to her, if I was watching this at like 15 in the 90s, there's no way this would have been what I saw back then. And it would have given me so much encouragement to see body shapes that were all sorts of different, and so I do think things are changing in a positive way. I hope so, but it does also take us as parents to make that conversation happen as well. So, okay, so for people who are listening and want to grab your book, where do they go and get that and find out more about you?
Yeah, well, my book is available everywhere in all the forms, like audio, print, and ebook. And I love when people buy it directly from my distributor, which is Hummingbird Press. And you can find the book on my website. You can read a little bit about it. My website's anourishingword.com. And if you don't see it at like your local bookstore or at your library, ask because it is available to bookstores and libraries right now. I really try to be very inclusive about where it is available all at once. Bookshop.org is another interesting place to order it from, where local bookstores actually get some of the proceeds,
Oh,
which
I
is
love
pretty cool.
that. I did not know about that. That's good to know. Awesome. Oh, I forgot to ask you one last question. If you could give one piece of advice to spark someone toward wholeness, what would it be?
Wow, that's such a wonderful question. I would say my one piece of advice, and it's just what came to me, which is sort of grounded in my somatic work, is very often feel your feet on the ground. Like literally, like put your attention on your feet because we're so up here in our heads so often. So kind of bring our energy down a little bit and feel your connection to the earth underneath you.
Yes, I love that. And that's a great one to do with kids too, especially little ones. I do that with the baby, the one who he's got all, his brain is all over the place all the time. So I grab his feet and I'm like, okay, do you feel my hands touching your feet? So I
That's
love
beautiful.
that. Yeah.
Yeah,
Oh,
that's
that's a
really
great
beautiful.
reminder. Well, thank you so much. This has been, I love talking to you because I just feel like we could probably talk for way too long. So thank you again for being on the show.
Definitely.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was such a nice conversation, Erin. I really appreciate it.
The tiniest spark leads to the biggest blaze, and I hope that today's episode sparks you on a journey to healing and wholeness. Thanks for listening to Sparking Wholeness. For more information on what I do and my coaching programs, or maybe just to reach out and say hey, find me at sparkingwholeness.com or on Instagram at sparkingwholeness. Have a fabulous week.